Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Pearlman. My guest is the award-winning poet Alice Fulton. Fulton is currently the Anne S. Bowers Professor of English at Cornell University. She has published many award-winning books, including her 2001 collection Felt, which was awarded the Rebecca Johnson Bobbitt National Prize for Poetry from the Library of Congress. She has also been the recipient of many honors, including fellowships from both the MacArthur and Guggenheim Foundations. She recently released a highly anticipated and gorgeous new collection of poetry called Barely Composed. It was published on February 2nd by W.W. Norton, and it's her first poetry collection in over 10 years. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tish.
It's a pleasure to see you again. Yeah. Now, as I said, this is your first poetry collection in over 10 years, and in that interim, you did write a book of fiction, The Wonderful Nightingales of Troy. Was this simmering all through these years, or did you suddenly start writing it and it came to being? Tell us how this evolved.
Well, I was writing a few poems when I was writing the fiction collection. I was writing short stories, and the short stories started 18 years ago or longer. So in that whole interval, I also would stop and write a poem. So the poems in this book, Barely Composed, were written since about the past 10 years or so. I've been working on them while I was working on fiction.
Yeah, it feels like lived life, the whole collection. It feels like it was real deliberative and that you were actually living while you were writing it. It's very interesting to me. Now, did you decide on a theme early on, or did you find the collection of poems in your drawer and put them together and say, wow, this looks like a whole book?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I didn't really decide on one theme because I don't like to write in any way that's very programmatic and prescribed. It doesn't feel free and innovative. So I had a few subjects I was interested in, and I kept coming back to various threads in the poems, and eventually I recognized them. I was kind of writing freely, and then I began recognizing the threads that were emerging and writing toward them. I would then try to draw them out and write more poems on those particular things. But I didn't want to write, there was no feeling of assignment about it. And it didn't feel like exercises or like something I had to do. I was just writing what struck me and what I wanted to write.
Yeah. So it actually did come from, most of them came from an organic place.
Yes.
As
you
lived
very
life.
Much.
Yeah.
Very much so. Yeah. From life, as you said.
Well, you know, what I sense from this whole collection, Barely Composes, is your passage through very difficult, trying times, pain, anger, and then finding some clarity by being able to write without it just being, you know, an anger poster, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So talk to us about that process, too. Were you going through all this stuff, and did you have to clarify some of your feelings during the writing?
Well, I think the writing does that for you, that you don't try to clarify it through the writing, but the process of writing helps you see it a little bit more clearly. But what I was seeing wasn't always pretty to look at, and it wasn't always a positive progress narrative that I was writing. It was just what was happening and what I was feeling, and I was stuck in a pretty dark place for a number of years, for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
So I was writing the poems from that place, and a little bit worried about how dark some of them were. And the book does come to a happier ending, I think, just as you were saying, that the last section has more newness. It has a sense of rebirth, I suppose, or things that are new. But that's partly a function of how I structured the book. It wasn't so much a function of how the order in which the poems were written. It was more putting the manuscript together so that the poems that were more about life and coming back to life were all at the end of the book.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think most people who read poetry are wanting to identify with somebody sharing the human experience. So I would never say poetry is too dark. I think poetry should be communicating with your fellow human being, you know.
That's
what I thought, and that's what I feel from this book, absolutely acutely. Now, I want to have you read a poem from Barely Composed. This one's called After the Angelectomy. I love this one. Do you want to tell us a little about it before you read it?
Sure. Well, at some point in this process of going through personal trauma, I felt that I had lost my angels, as some people might put it. I'm not sure I ever had any angels, to tell you the truth, but I lost a sense of whatever agnostic faith I had, that there might be a God, that there might be some force out there, completely left me. And I felt bereft, not that I had any particular religion. I didn't have any organized religion. But to lose a sense of possibility, that there might be a divine presence, or the universe itself might be listening, angels, in other words. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I wrote this poem about what it felt like to have an angelectomy, a removal of your angels. And that's pretty much it. I think toward the end of it, it gets more into the notion of human interconnectedness and how we help each other. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what there is, that we are each other's angels. And we don't need the supernatural when we've got a friend or we've got a beloved, mm-hmm. as I say in the poem. After the angelectomy, and where my organ of veneration should be, wormwood and gall, grudge sliver, whalebone, iron, bitters. I mean to say, the miniature waterfalls have all dried up in this miniature place, where day is duty cubed, time is time on task, and every mind optimized for compliance. Time to delint my black denim traveling stuff. The fluorescent major highlighter has dimmed to minor. I'm so dying, I wrote, when I meant to write, so tired. And when I sleep, I dream only that I'm sleeping. Please see my black stuffs dusted off. Night has no dilution anxieties, but only the infinites are happy. Math, time. Everything happy goes to many decimal places, while flesh passes through gradations of glory. I visualized it, the nurse said of the bed sore. Everything exists at the courtesy of everything else. Please see that my grave is kept clean. Beloveds, finite things in which the infinite endangered itself, excarnate to memory, and the divine substance has limited liability. You're kind, I tell the infinite. Too kind.
I love that. That reminded me of the epitome of barely composed, you know? Because I felt such energy from the poem.
Oh, good.
You know, so it, almost like a tug of war.
Yeah, trying to go toward the light while you're being pulled to the darkness.
Yeah.
I worry about that.
Yeah, that's the one that when I started thinking of you as a radiant demon.
Oh, good. I love that.
No, that was the poem that I thought, oh, that's a way to describe Alice's work. Now, a lot of your work has been described as experimental. Do you find that label intriguing or correct or what?
Honestly, I don't know what people mean by that.
You don't?
I know, because I think it's a word that we tend to throw around a lot with poetry criticism or poetry praise, and I don't think it's something that really happens very often. If you consciously set out to do it, it doesn't seem to really happen because you're too self-conscious, and I never consciously try to be experimental. And when I read poetry, I see very little that you would think is, oh, experiment. It's a slow process of change, I think, in poetics. And all the poets are learning from one another. And we're all together making an experiment. We're all going toward the future. And, you know, as I say in another poem I'll read later, we don't have to try to make it new. It becomes new by itself. So I never consciously experiment. And if people see anything in it that seems experimental, maybe it just means they haven't seen it before in poetry. But that doesn't mean that somebody else hasn't done it. I might have learned from someone, or I might be putting a slight twist on it that I'm not aware of. I think accident sometimes is a good thing to have in your poetry.
Yeah.
You can do something by mistake that turns out to be the best experiment.
Well, you know, I think we're sort of experimenting with our souls every day and everything we write and everything we communicate. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's what people mean.
Oh,
you know?
Well, that's really lovely.
It's an interesting thought to me, too. I'm a little annoyed by the word experimental, but I've seen it so much attributed to your work.
I agree with you. I find it empty. I don't mean in regard to my work, because I know people mean it as praise, and I'll take it.
Yeah, like you're unique, and you're writing something that no one else has written. Yeah,
it's nice, but when I really think about it, I don't think there's much experiment going on. It can't happen. So much has been done with the page, and what happens, it's change is something that's not pushed for, not tried for. I think it happens accidentally almost.
Yeah. Now, when I read this, especially this new book really touched me. I loved Felt as well, but this feels like a different evolution. And it feels like an invented language in some way, some of your lines and some of your thoughts. But then I think, of course Alice has invented a new language. It's one we already know, but she's just pointing it out to us. You know what I mean? It really feels that way to me.
Well, that's so beautiful. I mean, I do try to give strangeness to language. And sometimes when I'm sitting in my room composing the poems, it just presents itself to me as a possibility, a new syntax, a new way of deleting something, and the language becomes strange and new, I think. And I'm glad that you picked up on that. I love poetry as a foreign language.
Yeah, yeah.
Not too foreign, of course. We have to be able to understand it.
It is. It's a mysterious language. And I think the language you use, if people will take the time, is a language that will wake people up, you know? It seems like so many people are in a stupor.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Well, maybe they have to be.
Yeah, in some ways,
it's hard.
Probably a good thing.
Self-protective, that stupor.
Now, I want to have you read another from Barely Composed. This is my absolute favorite in the book, Malus Domestica. It's an amazing tour through the 21st century, as far as I'm concerned. Do you want to talk about it before you read it?
Well, I can try. Yeah, you know, the title, Malus Domestica, sounds like a bad country, but that's sort of an incorrect derivation, an incorrect translation. It actually means apple, and it's a botanical term for apple, Latin name for apple, but also it means unfaithful servant. Your unfaithful servant would be your malus or bad domestica. So all of that's behind it. And writing it, I was thinking about the U.S. and worrying about some of our actions, some of what we've done, foreign policy, thinking especially about the trauma we've inflicted on other people, other nations. Particularly in the poem, I write about the detainees, thinking about Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and waterboarding. And there's a quote from Dick Cheney in the poem, something he said about the interviews that were done with the detainees. There's a kind of euphemism that he used that enters into the poem. And it's really about language in a certain way and how we use language as a tool to make things prettier than they are and to euphemize things, like George Orwell in The Politics of the English Language, how we make up terms that let us live with things we shouldn't be living with. So language becomes a kind of protective barrier. There's a person who speaks in this poem. It's not me. It's a man who, I think of it as a man, who has a job as an apple evaluator. And this is his gig, and he has to say good things about these terrible apples, these bad apples. And in a way, I think it is about language, how we have to use it to manipulate. And also about jobs. People sometimes get stuck in jobs where they have to say things they don't feel, they don't mean, just to make a living. And that's the kind of job he's stuck in, this apple evaluator. So maybe that's enough said.
That's great.
Okay. Malus Domestica. I've come to dread the obligatory apple festival, where we must pledge our fealty to the strains of folk-drone music by the shores of an impaired lake, where former detainees weep to see children bobbing for apples with their hands tied behind their backs. And the shepherd in the sheepskin vest cries, "It's even more fun with a boot on your neck." We have a saying, "Nothing is allowed, but that which is allowed is compulsory." As an apple evaluator, I judge the russeting and bloom, the starch index at harvest. Judge is a euphemism for praise. A sample is handed through a hole. Sniff, bite, spit. I stroke the infected and stunted, those with a hint of worm. I praise till I'm stupid from the labor of praising these wicked apples. Pluton, 658. Has a shelf life of 12 million years. Belly slap Wehrmacht. Triples the cyanide of every seed. Gulag snowblower. Completely hollow. Might be an acquired taste. I get a lot of emails that say, "I've always wanted to be an apple evaluator. Once I cherished the onceness of every apple's blush, knowing we might never fall into these forms of flesh again. Now I envy the bees, drowsing in their blossoms, drunk on the mouthfeel. For them, there is no distance between the necessary and the good. "Why do you keep hitting me when I'm already dead?" the detainee asked at the enhanced interrogation. He wanted to wipe his eyes on mine, but I was too busy loading my pockets with apples for the penitential climb. Sniff, bite, spit. When I offered him the latest high bread, he said, "We have a saying, giving it away doesn't make a thing a gift."
If you're just joining us, my guest is poet Alice Fulton. We're talking about her new collection of poetry called Barely Composed. Did you want to say anything more about that poem?
Well, it occurred to me as I was reading it that it's about almost living in a police state. You know, we worry about that.
I was thinking that too. It's very political.
Yeah. It's about when a culture can become so infiltrated by police that we don't have any freedom, when things are compulsory but disguised as kind of festive. Mm-hmm. And that's behind it. That's behind it also. I don't know what else to say.
Yeah, no, it speaks for itself. And anybody who reads the news will know that this poem is very relevant.
One more thing I can say about that is that I was struck when I was reading about the detainees and the suffering and the torture, waterboarding in particular, that one thing that happened, simple things, when they returned, if they returned, to daily life, it was very hard for them to do things like go to the dentist because of the gag reflex from the waterboarding. And that got into the poem with the children bobbing for apples and how the detainee couldn't look at that, yeah. Could not look at kids bobbing for apples without having a flashback.
Yeah, yeah. That's a very powerful poem. Now you said in an interview once that you began to write poetry to counter loneliness. Do you still feel that's the urgency behind some of your writing, or has it manifested into a different reason?
I guess that it does that. I mean, when you've been writing it as long as I have, it's hard to even know what it does because it's so much a part of my life, the fabric of my life. But I think it's a consolation to me to be able to write it. I feel I can testify to things that are happening personally, and I don't want it just to be selfish and to be narcissistic, so I also like to take it to the public realm and write something like the poem we just heard. I think the sense of interconnectedness is powerful, and it does counter loneliness because you know, there are words that you give to other people, and sometimes people read them, and there's a connection. And I'm reading other people, you know, as an artist, as a poet. Mm-hmm. I'm reading others to learn from them. How did they do this? And you mentioned earlier, Tish, and I just loved what you said about how it's important for us not to pretend that darkness doesn't exist, because then everyone who's in that darkness feels completely alone.
Yeah, absolutely.
And bereft. But if we can acknowledge that, oh, I've been there, you know, I know it. You're not alone. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the powers of writing deeply, is that we're acknowledging to people, well, you know, I wrote this about it, and I was in that place, and think about this. And I take that from other poets myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll read other people and have that kind of relatedness to their work.
Yeah, yeah. It does make people feel less alone. I've had people come up and say that to me about listening to writers read. Now, I want to have you read another from Barely Composed. This one's called Still World Nocturne. And this one is so haunting to me, and we'll talk about it after you read it.
Oh, okay. Still World Nocturne. Listen, only night is watching the night nurse, and her smoker's voice is not a voice I trust. Yet I wake up, and the world's still here, a blur of how to speak or dress, which words or skirt or pair of powdered tear-resistant gloves. Sisters, only night is watching the night nurse, and no matter what we've heard, she's heard much worse. The vacuums roar, our mother crying, mother, and asking if the world's still here. While versed in flawed priorities, I numbly parse a sweat of student essays changing is to was. Children, only night is watching the night nurse. Tomorrow we'll confess all our concerns about that villanelle's dumb rhymes on love. We'll wake up to the world that's here, a burr of sun stuck to a catheter's gold purse, queasy music, wicked drugs. Still, mother, only night will watch as I, the night nurse, wake up to a world unhere, unyours.
That one haunts me. It reminds me of when I was in the hospital. Really, there's something spooky about them. To tell us
where it came from.
Where did it come from for you?
Well, that came from the experience of my mother dying and being her caregiver. And, you know, there were a few other people there at the time, but the darkness of the poem comes from watching her die, watching suffering, watching physical suffering, and having to be a witness to that. And, yeah, there was a terrible sense of hauntedness and creepiness and just despair, utter despair and powerlessness.
I think there's something scary about the medical world, too, you know?
Very.
They try to take over and they don't really know what they're doing half the time either, you know?
Yeah, of course.
But there's a darkness to it. Yeah.
Yeah, and the fact that I was teaching full-time, that I had a full-time job while I was trying to do this, to take care of my mother, was a terrible struggle because I was pulled toward wanting to take care of my students and wanting everything to earn my pay and so on and to do what I was supposed to do and to get dressed in the morning and to get out there, but also to get up early and take care of her and to worry about her. So I was very torn in two different directions and worrying about other caregivers, worrying about who was taking care of her when I wasn't there and how things were going. And, you know, it was certainly the hardest time of my life.
Who was the night nurse in this, though? I couldn't tell if it was you or someone else.
Oh, we did finally have a person who would stay all night, but for months I was awake at night. And my mother would call out for her mother, and I'd get up and run down the stairs. And, you know, when I felt like I wasn't close enough to her, I had to run down the stairs. But in the end, I put that I was the night nurse, even though there was another person at the end, a nurse, who was there for a while, maybe the last week. But I wanted to take responsibility at the end of this poem. I didn't want anybody to be blamed for what happened. It wasn't anybody's fault except mine. I think this is a good way to actually look at life in general. We can't blame people. We have to try to make it better, face up to what we've done. And so I had to say, well, what did I do? I was the night nurse. And that's
amazing. that's amazing. Was that the kind of poem that you just wrote and then looked at later and said, my God, I actually was able to write about this experience? It feels so urgent to me and poetic at the same time, which is amazing.
Thank you. No, it was slow to write because it's a villanelle. And I've only written one, and it's this one.
Wow.
And I will probably never write another one. They're so hard.
Yeah.
You know, it's in tercets, and it's got the rhyme pattern that's exact, and in certain repeating lines. A famous villanelle is Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night, of course, by Dylan Thomas. And that's a beautiful poem about his father's death. So when I was thinking about my mother, I realized I had a lot of obsessive lines coming back to me. And I thought, well, okay, instead of getting rid of them, I'll just use them again. I'll recycle them. It'll be a villanelle. I'll put in these recycling lines and use them again and again, obsessively, because I was obsessed. There's a thing I recently learned about, grief extension, I think it's called, where people can't get over something that happened. Prolonged grieving disorder.
I saw that in the New York Times.
In the New York Times. And I think I had that because this was years after my mother died that I wrote this poem, a couple of years. And I was still in that place. I was still back there in that room. I was still in the darkness. I was still running down the stairs and waking up.
Wow.
And so I thought, well, I will write a villanelle because it's so obsessive. And it took me a long time because of the form, the difficulty of that form.
But it's so nice that you got the night nurse to actually be cathartic for you in some way.
I don't know. I don't know if it's catharsis. To tell you, I have to be honest, I don't think these poems are cathartic. Maybe they will be someday. Maybe reading them will have that effect. Maybe when other people read them, they'll have that effect.
You know what I was thinking and I've read this several times, this collection. I was thinking that there's going to be another one that'll be more cathartic for you. This is like a prelude.
Yes.
Because you're still experiencing what you experience and trying to, you know,
process
it and you know, go through it. And
they were written in that dark period. Not all of them, you know, some of them. Toward the end of the book, there's even funny, and there's humor in the book, I have to say.
Oh, there is. I laughed a few
times.
There's
some things that are just so dark that you laugh, and you have to be able to laugh.
Yeah.
You have to be able to make fun of things, and that's the one protection. two protections. We have love, I think, connection to other people. And then we have being able to laugh at ourselves and being able to laugh at what's happening.
I know. I felt relief when I saw that you found some of the humor in what you were going through, because you can tell how intense it was. One more poem from Barely Composed. This one's called Make It New, and this is one of the lighter ones, and it's another one of my favorites.
Yes, right. It's the title came from a famous instruction from Ezra Pound, who said to poets way back when, a modernist poet, Ezra Pound, who said poets should make it new. This takes us back to one of the thing you asked about experimentation, because that was his precept, was make it new. And kind of arguing with that in this poem, I have it in quotes in the title, and the poem's a little bit sardonic about that possibility of making it new. And I'll just read it. Make it new. I find it helpful to imagine writing in a blizzard with every inscription designed to prevent snow crystals from drifting in. It's the opposite of making love to drudgery, what I do for a dying. Remove the bitter sediment trapped in the brewer. Avoid the hive mind. Go fly a kite. Raise a stained glass window in the sky. It will be new, whether you make it new or not. It will be full of neo-shadows, of then, both past and next, iridescent with suspense. Remember, time is not the treasure revealer, more a midge larva creeping through a waterfall, releasing suction feet. The Curiosity rover lands on Mars. New breaks the reckoning frame and rests in pieces. Let me collect its DNA from the tears on your desk.
I absolutely love that piece. Alice, we're almost out of time. I wanted to just ask you really quickly. A lot of women are afraid to show their anger and afraid to show their emotion. Did you ever hesitate about publishing any of these poems?
No. Mm-hmm. I know what you mean, Tish, because certainly I felt I had to be in control when I wrote them. And I didn't feel any of them were saying things that could hurt people. Mm. That's always my fear, I think, with anger, that I would say something I'd later regret that was very destructive to other people. Mm-hmm. Because we feel angry at other people as well as angry at ourselves. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to be sure I didn't say anything that would be destructive and hurtful to others. And that's why with the Night Nurse poem, I guess I'm the Night Nurse. I wanted to take it back to me. If anybody's to blame for whatever happened that was negative, I guess I can only look at myself and think about that.
Yeah. Well, it's an absolutely gorgeous collection, Alice. I thank you so much for sharing so much of it with us. Are you doing any readings in March, April, through the summer? Do you know yet?
I am. I'm reading at Buffalo Street Books in Ithaca. And
anywhere else?
Yeah. I'm also reading in Boston at Blacksmith House that's in April, I think. It's the last day in March I'm reading in Blacksmith House. And then I'm reading elsewhere in Massachusetts, I can't even quite remember, out of school, and Long Island. I'm reading at Stony Brook, Long Island, in April 1st. And then I do Hartford, Connecticut, a reading at University of Hartford. So a couple of things coming up.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Any contact information you can give people real fast?
Well, they can go to my website. It's all going to be listed there.
Okay.
And also I'm on Twitter.
So and that's AliceFulton.com?
On Twitter, I'm called Riff Sublime, but they can find it if they look for me under my name.
Great, great. Well, Alice Fulton, thank you so much for joining us. Again, the new collection is called Barely Composed. Go out and get it, everybody. Thank you so much, Alice.
Thank you, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.